successful secession movements in the Bible and in history. I was at a seminar conference for self-determination last Friday, and that evening I got someone who'd watched on Zoom, I suppose that's something like live stream the conference, and he said, I agree with you, but what's the ethical biblical basis for secession? Which, of course, I didn't exactly have time for in the short opportunity that we had on Friday, but it made me immediately go to the scriptures and say, well, you know, one of the most pivotal events in the Old Testament is Exodus, is it not? So Moses and Aaron came into Pharaoh and said to him, thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve me. The nation of Israel grew out of secession from Egypt. Egypt was the superpower of that time. Egypt was the greatest political, economic power in the world at that time, and military power. In the Bible, a nation is an ethno-linguistic people group with a shared faith. The scriptures make it clear that the Hebrews remained Hebrews. Even after 480 years in Egypt, they did not become Egyptians, because you are not a geographic accident, you're a demographic descendant. We're not geographic accidents. We are descendants of our parents and our grandparents and all the lines going back. So if you're born in an aircraft or in a ship in the middle of the Atlantic, what nationality are you? Well, your nationality of your parents. And Exodus makes that clear. The scripture emphasizes that all the families of the nations of the earth are to sing the praise of the Creator in every language and tongue. We read in Revelation 5 verse 9, and they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seal, for you were slain, and you have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Now, it may surprise some people to know that in heaven people will be identifiable as of different tribes, tongues, people, nations. They won't all look like some Chinese members of the Communist Party wearing the same pajamas with the same kind of hat. They will be distinct nations, languages, races, people groups. This is what the whole scripture is talking about. And when we speak about nations, we need to understand. Because unfortunately, many today are confused by the concept of nations. And this could be because there's a group of state representatives in New York calling themselves the United Nations. And of course, most of them have no legitimacy at all. They're not united, and they're not nations. Most of them are criminals, actually. They've had some of the biggest mass murdering thugs, like this cannibal, this Islamic Muslim persecutor of the church, who killed and ate the Archbishop of Uganda. Idi Amin was head of the Organization of African Unity, and he spoke to the UN as an honored guest. Fidel Castro, one of the worst mass murdering communist thugs and gangsters of all time, who turned an island paradise with one of the highest standards of living in all of the Americas into the lowest standard of living, where millions fled from his island paradise across the ocean to get on pieces of board and imaginative ways that they escaped from his disgusting regime. Of course, the Gaddafis and Amon al-Jihad and other kind of characters have been there. You've had every kind of thug, mass murderer, drug dealer, human trafficker in the world represented at the UN. So the United Nations is just the largest collection of unelected dictators, mass murderers, drug traffickers, and human traffickers on the planet. Most of them are just what I call gangsters with flags. They're not nations. They're not united. You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. I can't resist putting in quotes like that when you're talking about the UN. And that's why we've got this poster. This is a UN free zone. United Nations, keep out. Then you've got the United States, who deludes itself that it's one nation under God, indivisible. Well, you might be under God, but you can go to jail for mentioning God to kids or trying to evangelize the children in school and things like that. And of course, killing babies identifying gender and gender confusions. So, but nevertheless, they say they're one nation under God. But why 50 states in a voluntary union should be considered indivisible seems incomprehensible to most of us. But to many Americans, look, you can't even discuss this because it's like the angel Gabriel appeared with gold tablets and this is the map and this is the constitution and these are the borders and you can't redraw the border. You can support bombing people all over the world for next to no reasons. You can support bombing Syria, Iraq, killing how many? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions? I mean, who knows? And that's not a scandal. But if you question whether secession is right or not, you are stained and you are blackened beyond belief. You will be blackballed out. You will not be able to get a job in Hollywood and a whole lot of places like that, or any of the mass media. Americans are expected to make this pledge. We pledge allegiance to the flag, not the Constitution or to the God, but to the flag of the United Nations. How's this for adultery? One nation. According to Operation World, America is the most multicultural country on earth. And they delude themselves that they're one nation. Abraham Lincoln waged a ruinous war in which 650,000 people died to preserve the Union of what was meant to be a confederation. So much so that communists ever since then, like Fidel Castro, have had to come to pay homage before the idol of this great comrade. In this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever. Now, is that idolatry or what? But the war, since the war between the states, America has become more and more centralized, with central government overruling local governments, state governments, on such matters as legalized abortion. Do you know what Roe v. Wade is? 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court said that Texas didn't have the right to prevent someone having an abortion in Texas. Texas, along with 36 other states in America, protected preborn babies from abortion. Abortion was illegal by the laws of that state. What's the first duty of government? To protect innocent life. The first institution of government, Genesis 9 verse 6, given to Noah after the flood, was if anyone sheds innocent blood, his blood must be shed. You are to execute murderers. Simple. I mean, that's the first duty of government. If government doesn't do that, it's got no purpose. And state-mandated education. I mean, that started as recently as Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter started the National Education Department, where the state determined what textbooks are going to be used in the local states. This is a natural consequence of it moving from the United States of America are to after 1865, the United States of America is. It's moved from 50 United States to one United States of America, effectively. They might say states, but they mean what Washington, D.C. says. Well, you might recall the biggest reality when I was born, and for the first part of my life, the Soviet Union, the communist world, the Iron Curtain, the Cold War, that was the biggest reality. The legacy of the Second World War, Soviet Union took the whole of Central Europe. They kept calling it Eastern Europe, but that's Eastern Europe. There's the Urals over here, past Stone Grove. This is Eastern Europe. This is Central Europe. For goodness sakes, how on earth this became Eastern Europe? That's also, the West is pretty, there's not much difference between there and there. So the whole idea of Eastern Europe, it was Central Europe they betrayed into the hands of communism. When the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, broke up, this was considered a good thing. In fact, the best thing that happened in my lifetime. There was so much rejoicing that Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Georgia, and so many other captive nations were able to secede from the Union. Praise God there wasn't Abraham Lincoln and the Soviet Union in 1991. And it's a good thing for freedom that the Soviet Union was not indivisible. Why this bunch of baby killers in Washington, D.C. have an indivisible state, I don't know. The old Russian Empire, which became the Soviet Union, which is now the Russian Federation, consists of a lot of different nations, ethnic groupings, some beautiful flags, a lot better than that ugly red one. In fact, even days of the Soviet Union, National Geographic put out this, showing the different types of people and characters and everything right down from the astronauts and so on. So, so we even have astronaut peoples. And plainly, when you spoke about Russia, it was in fact a conglomeration of about 123 different language groups. It's a very big empire. Isn't it funny that in the 20th century, the two greatest empires are in denial that they ever were empires? Russia and America still are to this day denying that they're empires. They are empires. Any dictionary definition will tell you. It's obvious. What are your soldiers doing covering so many time zones and so many different countries around the world, causing so many wars? And yet the Americans and the Russians still deny their empires. And yet they both controlled far more territory than the Austrian Empire, the German Empire, the French Empire, and so on. And so today there's a whole lot of other nations that have come out, like Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania. These are nations. And so the map of Russia today is much more interesting than that big ugly red blob that we saw earlier under the Soviet Union. And there's some very intriguing countries and nations all throughout that area. But consider the destructive legacy of Versailles. There never was such a concept as Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia before the vindictive, destructive Versailles Treaty of 1919, the worst treaty in the history of the world. And those entities, Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, still don't exist today. They were bad ideas from the beginning, and free and independent nations have broken away from these empires. Yugoslavia, meaning the land of the South Slavs, included Slovenia and Croatia, which are definitely not Slavic. They were formerly part of the Austrian Empire, and they have Germanic language and culture. So the land of the South Slavs obviously didn't include the Croats or the Slovenes because they weren't even Slavs. The fragile political entity called Yugoslavia was, from 1945 to 1989, comprised of six republics, five nationalities, four languages, three major religions, two alphabets and two calendars, but only one political party, the Communist Party. Another kaleidoscope nation created by the Versailles Treaty that doesn't exist anymore is Czechoslovakia. It didn't survive long after the Iron Curtain collapsed and the withdrawal of the Soviet armies of occupation. In 1993, Slovakia seceded from Czechoslovakia peacefully after a referendum. Now, consider the secession of the 10 northern tribes of Israel from Judah and Benjamin. In 1 Kings 12, we read of the secession of the 10 northern tribes from the United Kingdom of Israel. So after reigns of King Saul, King David, and King Solomon, the United Kingdom ended, and it was divided when Solomon's son Rehoboam foolishly dismissed the wise counsel of the elders who had stood before his father Solomon. Instead, Rehoboam chose to rather listen to the irresponsible advice of the young men who had grown up with him, and as a result, he arrogantly dismissed the petition of his subjects. And he threatened to tax them even heavier and to burden them with more oppressive laws than they'd ever experienced before. Now, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, "What share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David." So Israel departed to their tents. So Israel has been rebellion against the house of David to this day, we read in 1 Kings 12. "There was none who followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only." Well, we see later that Benjamin joined in. When King Rehoboam assembled 180,000 warriors to fight against the house of Israel, sort of doing an Abraham Lincoln kind of stunt, "I will preserve the union by blood if necessary," God stopped them, declaring this secession was of him. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, "Speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Lord, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Let every man return to his house, for this thing is from me." Therefore they obeyed the word of the Lord and turned back according to the word of God. Now, if only some wise man of God had gone to Abraham Lincoln in 1861 and prevented that wicked, evil, destructive war, the worst war that Christendom had ever waged against itself to that date, how much better would the world be? There have been a lot of successful secession movements in history, such as Switzerland, which seceded from Austria in 1291. You should know of the great story of William Tell, who was an expert marksman of the crossbow. He refused to bow before the hat of Albert Gessler, the kind of governor of that area, who raised on a pole in the market square of Altdorf his cap, and he expected anyone walking past to bow before it. Well, when William Tell refused to bow, Gessler's cruel wrath was mixed with a curiosity to test William Tell's legendary marksmanship. So he, I mean, how wicked is this to expect a parent to put his child in jeopardy? He commanded him if he didn't, he would kill both him and his son. You must shoot this apple off his son's head with his crossbow bolt. He didn't have a choice. And at the number of paces determined by Gessler, he fired his crossbow and split the apple in half without harming his son. Then Gessler asked, why have you readied two arrows, or correctly speaking, quarrels? William Tell stated, if I'd missed with the first, I would not miss with the second in your own heart. This was considered insolent, seditious, and insubordinate. And so, enraged, Gessler had William Tell arrested and taken by boat across Lake Lucerne to Küssnacht, where he was condemned to spend the rest of his life in a dungeon in this damp castle. But a fierce storm enabled William Tell to escape to shore, where he later ambushed and killed Gessler with an arrow, launching the young Confederacy, which seceded from Austrian rule. And that's the story, or the beginning of the story, of Swiss independence. The first three cantons which formed the Swiss Confederacy were Schweiz, Uri, and Unterwalden. That's in 1291. Therefore, Switzerland's the oldest republic in the world, and it now consists of 26 sovereign cantons with their own police force, with their own taxation system, who keep central government, the federal government, they call it, very, very weak. In fact, the president of Switzerland changes every month on rotation. The governor of each canton takes it on a rotational basis. The president's just basically to shake hands and do some foreign speeches, and that's about it, because they are really serious about their independence. In fact, the Swiss are so serious that they invented referendums, direct democracy, and there was a referendum some years ago on whether to keep the pigeon regiment, the homing pigeon regiment, in the army. And the government wanted to abolish it. And would you believe it? The people got a big enough petition, I think you had to get 50,000 signatures, got a referendum, and they won. The government lost. And the logic of the people of Switzerland is governments can interfere with any technology, but they can't interfere with homing pigeons. Now, that's how much they love decentralization and distrust the central government. You've got to love a country like that. Despite Switzerland occupying the crossroads of Germanic and Romance Europe, as reflected in their linguistic and cultural regions, Switzerland's made up of Germans, French, Italians, and Romance, Protestants and Catholics, but its confederal decentralized direct democracy policy of armed neutrality has enabled Switzerland to stay out of ruinous world wars. And so, while Germans, French, and Italians were killing one another by the hundreds of thousands in the First and Second World War, Switzerland managed to maintain its neutrality. That's brilliant. Then, of course, you've got the United States of America. They're a product of secession. They seceded from Great Britain in 1776, demanding their chartered rights as Englishmen under Magna Carta of 1215. The 13 colonies constituted themselves as the United States of America with the Declaration of Independence, 4 July 1776. They maintained that the English government had failed to protect them, was failing to provide their rights as enshrined in Magna Carta, and they were absolved, therefore, of their allegiance to the British government in London, because this is the law of and the prince. If the prince does not fulfill his duty, the subjects are absolved of theirs. And these 13 colonies on the eastern seaboard of what today is the United States of America, seceded from Great Britain. There were other successful secessions. Just think of Prince William of Orange, after which our Orange Free State and Orange River is named, the father of Dutch liberties. He led the Netherlands to secede from Spain. If you look at our Greatest Century Reformation book and you look at the maps, you'll see what today is understood to be Belgium, Luxembourg, and Netherlands is written across as Spanish Netherlands. It was one country and it was owned by Spain. They were a colony of Spain. Belgium later seceded from Netherlands in 1830. Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836. Remember the Alamo. The Battle of the Alamo was a pivotal event in the War of Independence for Texas. And the cruelty and arbitrary lawlessness of the President Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, always find it amusing we've got a Santa Anna spur in Cape Town. I think does nobody know who Santa Anna was? He's not exactly the kind of person you want to name a spur after. This led other Texans to rise up and defeat the Mexican army at the Battle of San Jacinto, 21st of April, 1836, and they secured the independence of Texas from Mexico. And in fact, Texas, if it was independent, would be one of the largest armies and economies in the world. It would be in the top 10. And in this way, the United States grew in different ways. Texas is an example of secession. And they still have the right of secession written into their joining the United States. Nicaragua seceded from Guatemala in 1838. Nicaragua is another product of secession. Norway seceded from Sweden in 1905. Just a few years ago, we had Norway celebrating its centenary. That's quite intriguing. Prince Carl of Denmark was unanimously elected king by the Norwegian Parliament. He is the first king of an independent Norway in 508 years. And so he took the name Håkon VII. At national referendum, it confirmed the people's preference for monarchy over republic, and the peaceful separation of Norway from Sweden was effected 7 June 1905, not that long ago. And Norway is a very advanced and successful country. Finland seceded from Russia in 1917. They'd been under the Russian Empire for a very long time. In reaction to the Bolshevik Revolution, which was tearing Russia apart, the Finns set up their own parliament, which declared independence from Russia 6 December 1917. And Finland is one of the Viking countries, and you can tell the Viking countries all have the cross in their flag, testifying to how the Vikings came to Christ. And magnificent sharpshooters on skis, they beat the Red Army in 1940 and again in 1944 and preserved the independence. The Republic of Ireland seceded from Great Britain in 1922. Now, while I don't support Catholicism, I do support the fact that the Northern Irish fought to remain within the Union, because Britain was willing to give the whole of Ireland to the Republic of Ireland, to the Catholics. And the Royalists, the Loyalists, as they called themselves, in Northern Ireland, the Protestants, had to fight the British and the Catholic IRA to stay within the United Kingdom. Because they knew they would be oppressed by the Catholic majority in Ireland. The only protection is for the Protestant areas in Northern Ireland to secede from Southern Ireland and rejoin the British Isles or United Kingdom. And so, interesting, you had two secessions there. Ireland seceded from Britain, and then the Protestant Northern Ireland, Belfast, seceded from the Republic of Ireland. And there was a serious Irish civil war over that. But you've got a clear distinction between Protestant Britain and Catholic Ireland, two countries. Pakistan seceded from India in 1947. Basically, Pakistan means the land of the pure. It's a totally Islamic country. And initially, you had West Pakistan and East Pakistan. But aside from that, you've had wars between India and Pakistan from the beginning. It would have been worse if there'd been one country. But then later, Bangladesh or East Pakistan seceded from Pakistan, 1971 war. Taiwan seceded from China in 1949, and Taiwan had a far stronger economy than Red China for most of its history. In fact, the only reason why China's economy is so good now is because they have included Hong Kong because Hong Kong had a stronger economy than the whole of Red China, right up to its independence. So now China's economy looks like, wow, look how it's boomed. And yes, well, that's because just added the free enterprise tax haven of Hong Kong, which has been run by the British for all these years, to it. But Taiwan and Hong Kong dwarf the rest of China's economy. Taiwan is a super successful country, even if the United Nations doesn't allow them a seat and not even observer status in the UN, because they're scared of China. But this is the Republic of China. Because the Republic of China is the nationalist government of China that fled onto the island when they were betrayed in the revolution in China. Singapore seceded from Malaysia in 1965. Now, Singapore is basically a swamp. I don't know if you can sort of pick that up. It's wetlands. It's a real swamp. And it was just a mosquito-ridden swamp, basically. And that Singapore's been able to transform itself from a backwater swamp into one of the most advanced, successful countries in the world. And I know that because we've gotten Bibles, for example, our moral Bibles. The biggest project Frontline ever undertaken to that date, when we got the Moral Bibles printed, we got them printed in Singapore. Because Singapore could print 5 times more Bibles for the same price as we could get printed in Kenya. That included the transport, getting it to Kenya. So I said to the Kenyans, I'd love to give you the job, but you're overcharging and overtaxing. But Singapore gives better quality. And you can see the quality of the Bible. It's on display in our reception area behind glass. It's an excellent flexible cover, multiple color maps, 2 ribbons for Old and New Testament. It's nicely made. It's good quality, excellent quality, better than would have been done in Africa at a fifth of the price, 20% of the price that Africa would charge. And so obviously people like us are getting our printing done by Singapore frequently because Singapore's just, they do it better, quicker, cheaper. And Singapore's a good example of free enterprise. I don't know how many people remember that Namibia seceded from South Africa in 1990. It was the fifth province. And there, rugby, cricket, and so on would compete with the Cape, Orange Free State, Natal, and Transvaal. It was the fifth province, South Africa. That's why we were on the border of Southwest Africa, was because Southwest Africa was actually administratively part of South Africa. And Southwest Africa seceded from us. And to be honest, they seem to be doing better than us right now. They've got lower crime and their fuel's less expensive and a whole lot of things is a lot better because they don't have the same insane government we have, screaming expropriation without compensation, demonizing the white members in the country and trying to make a race war in the country. So those are just some examples. Now, I've been eyewitness to some successful secessionist movements. Sometimes people think trying to reach for secession is reaching too far. I mean, honestly, do you think you can catch an eagle? Well, cats can do things that most people can't do. They've just got this flexibility. Gymnasts. As a missionary who for 38 years has concentrated on serving persecuted Christians in restricted access areas, I've traveled in 42 countries and I've worked in 38 countries across 4 continents. And this included throughout Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. In fact, I was smuggling Bibles through Checkpoint Charlie into East Germany through the Iron Curtain back in the 80s. And on my honeymoon, I was trying to keep up with my parents-in-law who were driving in a car in front. And Lenora telling me, go faster. And I'm going 160 down the Autobahn. And to keep up with Bill Bethman was very hard because he was always just screaming ahead there. And I hit 260 kilometers an hour. And Lenora is actually saying, you're losing him, go faster. And a Porsche comes straight past. The experience in German Autobahns, something else. Never traveled so fast as trying to keep up with Bill Bethman. He had the front car, the second. We used 2 cars so that we could split when in Eastern Europe and we could carry more Bibles and so on. So I was doing Bible smuggling into Czechoslovakia. We stood at the border for 5 hours before being expelled because Bill Bethman was known there. We went into Yugoslavia, went to Hungary, went to Romania, and that was all part of my honeymoon. The Iron Curtain stretched from Trieste in the north down all the way, from Stettin in the north down to Trieste in the south. It was a serious, genuine Iron Curtain. Behind the Iron Curtain were 150 million Christians betrayed by the West into the hands of Stalin's KGB. 10 nations, 150 million Christians betrayed behind this Iron Curtain. And so Europe was divided between slave and free, and communism was the reality, and the greatest reality in my time. I did not think the Iron Curtain would come down in my lifetime. I was absolutely convinced. I saw the Iron Curtain. I thought it would be up till Jesus came. I remember Brother Andrew coming along to Hospital Christian Fellowship, which was the first mission I was working at. And he said, we're going to start a Jericho prayer march for 7 years to bring down the Iron Curtain and open up the Eastern countries to the gospel. And I sat there when he's asking us to pray, thinking, Brother Andrew is off his rocker. I mean, there's just no way. There's no way. There's not a snowball's chance in hell that the Iron Curtain is going to come down in our lifetime. And you may think, well, you know, how can you have been so disbelieving? You had to live in it at the time. In the wake of the Second World War, the Iron Curtain splitting Europe was just one of the great realities that most of us never questioned, that it could ever be reversed. But the Leipzig prayer meeting and all the rest, and these pictures I took while trying, that's Bill Bath in the front. That's the Merc that I normally couldn't see because it was so far ahead, trying to catch up with him. And that's going into Romania. And Romania, Ceausescu, May Day celebrations, missionary religion of communism, they're claiming the whole world for communism. Look how they've even got the flag of Chile and India, and they've got Norway's flag. Yes, you can pick up all sorts of countries that weren't communist. They're claiming the whole world for Karl Marx. Here you can see there's Norway flag. There's Spain, Italy, Denmark. It wasn't just communist flags, that every country, they're claiming the whole world for communism. See, a globe, very symbolic. And again, 1st of May, notice the flags, not just of Soviet Union, but Red China. They were meant to be split between them, but the Warsaw Pact had the communist flag of North Korea and Red China at the same time. Hungary, look at that, Yugoslavia's flag. Yugoslavia is meant to be the leader of the non-aligned countries in the world, which is total nonsense. They were as communist as they come, as the red star in the middle depicts. But this is what you see at May Day. So the split between the Sino-Soviet split between China and Russia was just a charade. So that America could at one point say, we've got to support China against Russia because Russia's the real enemy. And then a few years later, we've got to support China against Russia because Russia's the main enemy. We've got to, and the American Congress just kept shipping arms and weapons alternately to China or Russia, building up the enemies, convincing the American people that you had to do this. Sell wheat to Russia for less than it cost the American farmers to produce it and things like this because the Russians couldn't feed themselves. Without the help of the West, the communists couldn't have survived. Capitalists financed them all the way along until Ronald Reagan said enough of this. And he bankrupted the Soviet Union in his 2 terms in office. Albania, also with Bill Bethlen. When I first visited Yugoslavia and I heard people in Croatia speaking about the need for independence, I was highly skeptical. Yugoslavia consisted of 6 republics, 5 nations, 4 languages, 3 major religions, that's Catholicism, Orthodoxy, and Islam, 2 alphabets, but only 1 political party, the Communist Party. How's that for diversity? This was the reality. This was a brutal, savage Marxist dictatorship. If you doubt that, you need to read books like God Smuggler and Going Through by Bill Bethlen. But in 1990, the first multi-party elections were held in Croatia. On 25 June 1991, Croatia declared independence. That was spectacularly fast. It made your head spin. Which came into effect 8th of October 1991. They went from 0 to 100 in about 18 months. So, phenomenal. It came out of nowhere. I mean, I'd heard it before anyone else was talking about it, but I didn't believe it when I heard it. By 15th of January 1992, Croatia was recognized as an independent country by the European Economic Community. This is Dubrovnik, which was shelled. It suffered siege by the communists for quite a while. It's just extraordinary how they've rebuilt it magnificently. Old Crusader town. The aggression by Yugoslavia was effectively ended August 1995 with a decisive victory for Croatia. Since then, 5 August has been observed as Victory and Homeland Thanksgiving Day in Croatia. Slovenia's Alpine. It's actually Austria. It was just taken away and given to Yugoslavia to be vindictive, basically. It's just a Versailles Treaty creation, putting it into Yugoslavia. You might recall, if you've seen The Sound of Music, that the Captain von Trapp was a naval captain. You might have thought, how's that possible? Austria's a landlocked country. Well, Austria used to have such a phenomenal navy that they saved Europe from the Turkish invasion back in the Battle of Lepanto 1571. Austria's navy was a significant major navy for many years, but to deny Austria access to the sea, they just took a whole lot of this and gave to Yugoslavia or to Italy. And Slovenia is one of the groups of Germanic peoples that was just thrown under the bus for the communists to destroy. But in 1987, a group of intellectuals articulated the case for Slovene independence. That was total treason, seriously seditious, and completely illegal for the communist state of Yugoslavia. Brave people. They formed the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights. Demands for democratization and independence for Slovenia forced the communist government to enact a number of democratic reforms. Remember, this is the 80s. Ronald Reagan's changing the equation, and Margaret Thatcher as well, P.W. Botha in South Africa. We were thrashing the commies in Angola at that time. And so there was a whole lot of dynamics on the go. The Russians were getting mauled in Afghanistan. They weren't doing very well in Nicaragua either. And so the communist empire was rattling, and there was cracks in the wall. And so this was a fortuitous time. In September 1989, the constitutional amendments were passed to introduce parliamentary democracy to Slovenia. On the 7th of March 1990, the Slovenian Assembly changed the official name of the state to the Republic of Slovenia. In April 1990, the first democratic elections in Slovenia took place. On the 23rd December 1990, more than 88% of the electorate voted in a referendum for a sovereign, independent Slovenia. And this is just staggering how fast this moved. I'd been there barely a year and a half earlier when they were talking about it and thinking, you know, no chance. Just irresponsible, impossible, pipe dream. It couldn't happen. Slovenia declared independence 25 June 1991. The Yugoslav People's Army invaded on the 27th of June 1991, and this led to what has been known as the 10-Day War. I thought it was a 9-day war, but officially it's called a 10-day war now. The result was the Brejuni Agreement, the withdrawal of the Yugoslav army, who got a serious blood nose, as depicted by this ex-Yugoslav tank. And in December 1991, new constitution was adopted, followed by laws for denationalization, privatization of all state enterprises by 1992. They moved very quickly to free enterprise. The members of the European Union recognized Slovenia as an independent state on the 15th of January 1992. There you can see Slovenia. It was the part of Austria that linked it to the coast and Dubrovnik's, basically right down there on the Adriatic. And so every one of the six republics in the old Yugoslavia have split up and got independence. No thanks to the cursed Versailles Treaty that kept them enslaved for something completely unnecessary for over 70 years. And so today Yugoslavia looks a whole lot more reasonable, manageable. Anyone recognize this picture? It's taken from the 007 movie License to Kill. No, Living Daylights. Living Daylights. That was that one. It starts off with Bratislava, Czechoslovakia. At this time in the 80s, Bratislava was chills run down your spine. Daniela's got happy memories of Bratislava, but when I went to Bratislava, it was hardcore communist, dark, dingy, terrifying, cold, the fear you could just sense. But when I first traveled to Bratislava in Czechoslovakia, talk of the Slovakians seceding from Czechoslovakia seemed unrealistic and impossible. This is part of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall, they're right behind. And every attempt of people to rise up and to try and overthrow the communist oppressors, such as what happened in 1956 in Hungary, when the people burned the pictures of Stalin and Lenin and smashed down the idols of Stalin and demanded the Russians get out of Hungary. The result was the Russian invaded. They wiped out a quarter of a million people. The uprising in 1956... Bill Bathman reports on it in his book, going through how the people were recording and calling on the people of the West to come and help them. And they had been responding to the American Radio Freedom was encouraging them to rise up. And they rose up and expected support, and America gave them nothing and NATO did nothing. And their towns were destroyed by the Russians. Later in 1968, the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia, it looked like the Soviets were allowing them to to democratize what they called communism with a human face. Prague Spring ended with bloodshed. Every one of the Warsaw states, Warsaw Pact states, invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968. If you've read Brother Andrew's Going Through, or Bill Bethman's Going Through Brother Andrew's God Smuggler, you'll know that Brother Andrew says he phoned a brother in Austria and said, I'll meet you in Wenceslas Square in Prague. And that was Bill Bethman. And they raced one another. Bill Bethman got there first. He had less distance to travel coming from Salzburg. And everyone was pouring out of Czechoslovakia. They went in because the Russians were invading. And they took lots of Russian Bibles. They were standing on the tanks, giving Bibles to Russians as they were invading Czechoslovakia. And Brother Andrew and Bill Bethman working shoulder to shoulder in Wenceslas Square in Prague. But when other people were fleeing, they said, well, yeah, the Russians are coming to us. Let's. In fact, there were posters up on the walls in Prague saying, the Russian circus has come to town. Please don't annoy the bears, which was one of the posters that was up at the time. Bill Bethman describes how the Russian tanks came straight in and drove right over people's vehicles, flattened combis, Beetles, whatever cars were there, shaved them off. And this is what town looked like. No other traffic, just the tanks. Now you could see and sort of imagine what the Czech people were saying to the Russians, you know, like, go home, or words to that effect. Here's a picture of Bill Bethman by some modern art This was in Bratislava, in Czechoslovakia, the hammer and the sickle and the red star. Ghastly, ugly, non-art. But the Christians were adamant Slovakia must become an independent country. And it did. Following the collapse of communist rule in Czechoslovakia in 1989 and the withdrawal of the Soviet Red Army, the Slovak Socialist Republic was renamed the Slovak Republic. And on the 17th of July, 1992, Slovakia declared itself a sovereign state, meaning its laws took precedence over those of the federal government in Prague. And throughout the autumn of 1992, negotiations with the Czech federal government resulted in the vote, 31st of December 1992, to dissolve Czechoslovakia. The Slovak Republic and the Czech Republic went their separate ways after 1 January 1993. And the overthrow of the communist rule in Czechoslovakia is called the Velvet Revolution, because it was generally peaceful. And a peaceful separation of Czech and Slovakia is called the Velvet Divorce. But interestingly, they've become good friends and allies since, again showing the fact that good fences can make good neighbors. When you don't feel threatened by your neighbor, then you can actually work for mutual benefit. Then you come to the Baltic states. This is really inspiring. Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia are the three Baltic states because they're on the Baltic Sea. And they've been occupied over the centuries by Sweden, Poland, and Russia. They're a mixture of Vikings and Germans, effectively Germanic and Viking people, the Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians. And the Republic of Latvia was established on the 18th of November, 1918, when it seceded from the Soviet Union. As the Bolsheviks took the Soviet Union, they said, farewell, das vidania. And they seceded, and they had a few 21 years of independence. And then 1940, Latvia was invaded by the Soviet Union. Later, Latvia was liberated by the German forces during Operation Barbarossa in 1941, and many of them fought alongside the Germans against the Soviets for the rest of the war. In 1944, the Soviet Red Army again invaded Latvia and forced it back into the Soviet Union. There's a Latvian film out with English subtitles called 1944, which is just about that final battle where they were fighting for their lives against the Red Army coming in to destroy them. Starting in 1987, the Singing Revolution called for Baltic emancipation from communism and Soviet occupation. They used concerts and outdoor events to sing about things like freedom and independence. And it was the Singing Revolution. And there's, in fact, a film out on it, on the Singing Revolution. On the 4th of May, 1999, the Declaration of the Restoration of Independence of the Republic of Latvia was issued. And on 21st of August 1991, Latvia declared its independence with a blue, black, and white flag. Latvia has been declared the capital of culture in Europe, and its capital, Riga, has hosted the Choir Olympics, which my daughter Daniela took part in as part of the Cape Town Youth Choir. I think it was the 140 choirs, if I remember right. But 140 choirs from around the world gathered in Riga for this event. And they are a singing people. It's a beautiful culture. Estonia was also occupied over the centuries by Polish, Swedish, Russian forces, and they also declared their independence in 1918 on the 24th of February, and on the 6th of August 1940, Estonia was invaded and occupied by the Soviet Red Army and incorporated into the Soviet Union. Estonians resisted the Soviet occupation for years, and after the Second World War, they continued to resist for 10 years after the war. The so-called Forest Brothers resistance movement opposed the Soviet policy of collectivization, where people lost their farms and ended up working on concentration camps effectively. The forced removals of Estonians were shipped off, many of them to Siberia, with Russians coming in to take their place to basically bring down the majority of the Estonians in Estonia. These are some of the few pictures that exist of these Forest Brothers, these Estonians who were fighting against the Marxists. This chap must have been quite a character to have had a hawk on each shoulder. I'd like to know more about him. In 1987, the Singing Revolution began. By 1988, the Popular Front of Estonia became the standard bearer for Estonian independence. And the Estonian National Independence Party was the first non-communist party in the entire Soviet Union. It demanded full restoration of independence. The churches were venues for the singing. In fact, Bill Bathman writes in his book going through of how they worked in Tallinn. He was doing a preaching crusade in Tallinn, and what had happened is the church had been closed. So the communists closed their church. So they invited Bill Bathman to come and be their preacher. And so because the church was closed, they had him preaching outside. And so the crowds came and more people came in. This is so interesting and so surprising. And so using this foreign evangelist as a guest speaker, in the end, the communists came, unlocked the church and begged them to please get off the street and move back in because they're blocking the traffic. They're taking over the whole intersection. And they were, in fact, attracting more and more converts too. So after a while, I actually opened the church and pleaded with them to go back to the church. And that's the kind of people they were. Just outstanding. Estonia never joined the USSR, as they said. On the 16th of November 1988, the Estonian Supreme Soviet issued a sovereignty declaration asserting the primacy of Estonian laws over Soviet Union laws. And then on the 23rd of August 1989, about 2 million Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians participated in a mass demonstration forming the Baltic Way Human Chain, sort of like a life change, but they actually would link arms, stretching with flags and all, and singing. 2 million. It stretched 630 kilometers, demanding restoration of independence. Now, remember, this is 1989. The Soviet Union is still in business. The Iron Curtain is still up. The Berlin Wall has not yet fallen. These people are brave. And you can also see the uniquely, the kind of Lada cars, which is, as Bill Bathman said, they're Lada junk. In 1990, the Congress of Estonia was formed as a representative body of Estonian citizens. And in March 1991, a referendum was held where 77% of the voters support independence. But the only ones who didn't were the Russians who had been bussed in as part of the forced removals of Estonians. A Moscow coup attempt was exposed and resisted, and Estonia declared its restoration of independence 20th of August 1990. Remember, they'd already declared independence back in 1918. So this is a restoration of their original independence, which is now a public holiday in Estonia. They know what oppression is. They really, really suffered. The last units of the Red Army finally left Estonia in 1994. So it took years after the independence before the Red Army fully moved. So they didn't wait for the Red Army. Some people are saying, you know, well, what would the ANC do if we declare independence in the Cape? Well, you know, it's not their call. It's not their choice. If we take the opportunity provided by the law of both our land and our constitution and of the African Union and of the United Nations, all of which assert the right for self-determination of people on the basis of language, shared religion, shared territory, or shared culture, or shared ethnicity. Any one of those five categories, you've got an international and national legal right to assert self-determination, which is exactly what the Estonian people did. The last units of the Red Army left Estonia in 1994. In 1992, Estonia launched economic reforms for privatization, free market economy. They didn't wait for the evacuation of the Red Army. They started immediately. In 2004, Estonia joined the European Union and NATO. And a very cheerful singing people they are too. As they say, Estonia is the singing nation. And this is just one of their singing events. Lithuania seceded from the Soviet Union on the 16th of February 1918 to form the Republic of Lithuania. In 1940, Lithuania was invaded and occupied by the Soviet Red Army. And on 11th of March 1990, a year before the formal dissolution of the Soviet Union, Lithuania became the first Baltic state to declare itself independent. Now, while Estonia and Latvia are mostly Protestant, Lithuania is mostly Catholic. So there's a difference between them in culture, even though ethnically they're very similar. On 11th of March 1990, a year before the formal collapse of the Soviet Union, Lithuania became the first Baltic state to declare itself independent. On 11th of March 1990, the Supreme Council announced the restoration of Lithuania's independence. And on 28th of March 1990, the Soviet Union imposed an economic blockade in Lithuania meant to strangle them. It lasted 74 days. Nothing allowed to cross the border. The blockade lasted, but Lithuania stood firm and would not renounce their freedoms. When the Soviet Union attempted a coup in Lithuania, storming the Seimas Palace, Lithuanians vigorously defended the council and inspired other Soviet republics to secede from the Union. Here, they massed out. I mean, what a mass of people coming and saying, we want our independence. And it was violence in Lithuania. The Russians used nerve gas. They rode over people. They shot people. There was a lot of violence initially, but they had to move on. They realized that the days of being able to do this had come to an end. Shortly after the 11th of February 1991, the Parliament of Iceland voted to confirm Iceland's 1922 recognition of Lithuania's independence. They said it's still in effect. We don't need to recognize Lithuania's independence because we already recognized it in 1922 and we never recognized the Soviet Union's illegal occupation of Lithuania. So Iceland was the first to establish full diplomatic relations with Lithuania. And that's what any secession needs. It needs one country, one nation to recognize its independence, and that opens the door. Iceland stated full diplomatic relations need to be reestablished as soon as possible, and so on the 25th of October, the citizens of Lithuania voted in a referendum to adopt the new constitution. And here you've got Lithuania, and you've got Latvia, and you've got Estonia's flags together, sort of sister nations. On the 31st of August, 1993, the last units of the Russian army withdrew from Lithuanian territory. Again, it took time. They didn't wait for the Russians to leave before asserting their independence. They asserted their independence, and in time, the federal forces had to move out. Since 2004, Lithuania has become a member of NATO and of the European Union. And so here you can see just some of the nations that have split out of the Soviet Union and others. These are just the group in 2004 that joined the European Union, for example. And here you can see Lithuanian National Independence Day being celebrated with enthusiasm in the main streets. Beautiful country and magnificent buildings and architecture. So again, we're just reminded of the fact the diversity of people. Why should the Soviet Union be indivisible? Why should the United States be indivisible? Is it really reasonable that a nation of 100 and something million, in the case of the Soviet Union, or 300 million, in the case of the United States of America, should be ruled by one government? And so these are now independent countries, free people. Since 1995, I've been involved in the campaign for South Sudan's independence. From 1995 to 2002, I conducted 27 missions into Sudan. This is when it was Islamic Sudan. It was illegal to travel there behind the lines into the Nuba Mountains, walking up and down Nuba Mountains in the 1040 window in this area, which is ankle-twisting terrain with the baobab trees, which I thought only lived in my old country of Rhodesia, but up there too. People living in these rocky houses, And of course, where the church had been burned and bombed and attacked, they were under fire. Christians under fire in Sudan. And I made it the major focus of our mission from 1995 on to focus on Sudan and to alert people to this hidden Holocaust, Africa's forgotten war, where Christians are under fire, where churches are being bombed. And I ministered in about 1,200 churches. I don't, and 1,200 meetings. And every church and school that I spoke at, not one of them had ever avoided bombing. They'd all been bombed at least once. One church I ministered in been bombed 18 times in a 12-month period. And so I was able to supervise the delivery and distribution of over 500,000 Bibles and Christian books in 24 languages throughout South Sudan and the Nuba Mountains, coming in by Cessna caravans, being delivered to the Dinka, to the Moro, to the Zandi, to the Bari, Sunday school books, hymn books, catechisms, school textbooks for 100 schools we helped to establish in South Sudan, just in Equatoria. The caravan's the workhorse of missionary aviation. Missionaries had to build this bridge across the Yei River because the bridge had been blown up. The airstrip was on one side and the hospital was on the other. And then off to the Nuba Mountains in these old Second World War vintage DC-3s or Dakotas with turboprop conversion, ex-South African Air Force. This is an ex-South African Air Force Dakota being flown by an ex-South African Air Force pilot, landing in a newly liberated airstrip, which had been under the control of Arabs until just a few months before. 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments in seven different languages, and they were overwhelmingly distributed in newly liberated territory. And that Land Rover at the back, that ambulance, is one that we bought in South Africa, drove up from the Transvaal to Sudan to serve the people at the battlefront and get them to the hospital, the only hospital in the area. The Krungu people, who I was told were an unreached people, but we discovered there's a lot of them who were Christians. During this time, I conducted over 1,200 meetings in Sudan. Chaplain services, preaching to the soldiers, getting to the battlefront, ministering to the men of the SPLA, church conferences in the forest, city hall, churches in the Nuba Mountains, where the trumpet is blowing and where the banner is waving as Isaiah 18 speaks. This is just coming down over the top of the hill to go down to Kauda, the church that had been bombed 18 times in a 12-month period. At the same time, I had about 1,000 meetings, radio and TV programs internationally to campaign for South Sudan's independence, all over America and Europe in particular. We produced posters, newsletters, more posters, books. Like Faith and Defiance Sudan went through three editions, 1996. One was over 100 pages. 1998 was over 200 pages. And the third edition from 2010, that was over 300 pages. So each one being sort of double the previous. And this became one of the flagships to alert people. Now, I've never considered myself a cameraman, but I realized the need to record this forgotten war. So I got hold of a video camera and learned how to use it. And some of that footage ended up in Sudan, the hidden Holocaust and terrorism persecution. But most of it, we've gotten Pat Matushian of Jeremiah Films to come in and film. Another war correspondent came in, did the 3 days in Sudan. And we've put all these together in one video. Also persuaded Samaritan's Purse to come in. It may interest people to know that initially, even the leaders of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, were skeptical that the map could ever be redrawn, as the African Union had insisted that the borders couldn't be changed. It was like the angel Gabriel had appeared with gold tablets, and this is the borders, and you weren't allowed to change it, which is bizarre, because we thought everything colonials did was bad. Why won't you redraw the boundaries to recognize ethno-linguistic demographic realities? But the African Unions steadfastly resisted this. I argued steadfastly with Colonel John Garang, he's the second from the left, and with Commander Silva Kier, he's the third from the left, he's the second Commander SPLA, that only independence for South Sudan could secure their future and their freedom. I think I was the first to draw the map with South Sudan being a separate entity. the Green North for Islam, the White South for the Christians. You can see the crosses represent over 20% of Christians, crescent moons over 50% of Muslims, the red men where there's wars, and we also put in, if it was more than 50% Islamic, it's painted in green and so on. So just to give you a feel, this is a map printed in Frontline News, which we were sending out in the 1990s already. I think this was 1996, we drew this map. And when I showed this, the people, they were saying, but New Sudan will never happen. What they call today South Sudan. Yeah. The leaders of the SPLA didn't think it was possible. But I said anything else would mean a continuation of oppression by the Arab North. They would remain a minority in their own country. Although blacks were a majority in South Sudan, they were a minority in the whole country of Sudan. And only redrawing the map would make them masters of their own country. Or they'd be minority in their own country. Missionaries had pleaded this very point with Great Britain in 1955 on the eve of independence. Do not include the black Christians and animists of the South into an Arab-ruled Sudan. They've got a different language. They've got different culture. They've got different religion. They've got different calendar. They've got different alphabet. You cannot put them together in one country. You're asking for oppression of the Christian and animist black minority at the hands of the Muslim Arab North. Suggestions were made, please incorporate Equatoria at least into Kenya or Uganda if you can't give it its own independence. But to no avail. From the very first day of independence, 1 January 1956, the Arab North sought to Islamize and Arabize the South with brutal oppression, great devastation, and tremendous loss of life. I showed them from Sudan's own history and from the teachings of Islam why the only way to be free of Sharia law and Arab oppression was to fight for full independence and sovereignty of South Sudan and Nuba Mountains. You'll see early materials put out by the SPLA and John Grang. He is talking about autonomy. We're fighting for autonomy of the South. But they weren't fighting for independence. The thing is, autonomy is not good enough. Here I'm meeting with Silva Keir. Silva Keir is the commander of the SPLA. At that stage, he is second command. And John Grang was the commander. This is the governor of Equatoria, Bishop Bulunduli, and Kenneth Beringer, the man who gave me the Macedonian call to come to Sudan. Although they were skeptical, highly skeptical, that this was at all possible, today South Sudan is an independent country, and Salva Kiir has been its first president since 9 July 2011. Let my people go was one of the themes we used. All for separation. They voted in 2005 in a referendum for secession. And it was overwhelming. It was in the 90% for independence. And that independence came about in 2011. And here in Juba, the celebrations, some of the veterans who'd lost limbs. We never saw these uniforms during the war. They didn't have uniforms during the war. You may wonder about that interesting Texas hat. That hat that Salva Kiir wears like a crown was a gift that he got from President George Bush Jr. when he visited him in Texas. He gave him this hat and he's worn it ever since. And you can see a lot of Sudanese now following that trend because George Bush has started a fashion trend over there. And here's lifting up the constitution of the new country. What does this tell you? A man raising arms and with joy, but he lost his hands due to the war, due to Sharia law, due to Islam. To this day, our identity is Southern and African, not Arabic and Islamic. We are not worse Arabs, but we're better Africans. There's a lot being said there. This is a case for secession. And while the independence of Sudan may not have gone the way we wanted, and they didn't follow some good advice, and they were given some very bad advice by Jimmy Carter, which they followed, nevertheless, the map was redrawn. South Sudan is a free and independent nation recognized around the world. The first time that the Berlin Conference boundaries in Africa have been changed and adjusted. So it's historic, free at last. Now, of course, the Nuba Mountains was not included in that independence of South Sudan. We must keep praying for South Sudan, but we need to continue to campaign for the freedom and independence for the Nuba Mountains, an island of Christianity in the Sea of Islam. They are still suffering. And praise God for the teams that continue to go there and deliver books and Bibles and textbooks, exercise books, and a whole lot of other materials for most of these youngsters, the first time they're receiving any book or any possession even. So you can read about that and the projects that we've got ongoing. Teams have driven from here overland to Sudan on many occasions. Once, Bill Bathman did it. In the year 2001, I took Bill Bathman up to Sudan, and when he came back, he bought a Land Cruiser, filled it up with all the materials we had, and drove it all the way over to Sudan to donate the vehicle and the materials in it to Sudan. So it wasn't enough for me to fly him into Sudan. He wanted to drive overland. And that's a man in his 70s, sort of like Caleb, give me that mountain. So we've had teams driving overland. The courageous Nuban Christians continue to resist the Arabization, Islamization policies of the Khartoum government in the South Kordofan region. Redrawing the map is absolutely essential to recognize ethno-linguistic demographic realities and to avoid further loss of life and future conflicts. We must not continue to follow in the footsteps of failure. Centralization and a unitary state is as doomed to failure as the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel, pyramid-type structures. You see this European Parliament Strasbourg that was pictured standing outside? It's built deliberately to model itself on Bruegel's here's a Brussels artist, famous painting in the 1600s of the Tower of Babel. Now notice this post in the middle, European Union putting out Europe, many tongues, one voice. With that, and look at the stars, and the stars are inverted, so it forms like the occultic pentagram, like the goat's horns and ears and beard. Why did they put the stars in that way? This just shows the EU is in the hands of occultic anti-Christian elements. Many tongues, one voice. What are they saying? We're going to reverse God's judgment at Babel. Look how it's built. It's built in a form of an incomplete building with scaffolding incomplete. That is the EU centerpiece. We need to emulate examples of excellence such as the decentralized models of Switzerland, an island of sanity in an insane continent in many ways. This is, by the way, the parliament in Bern, and what a magnificent country to be in. This is their parliament. This is the Landsgemeinde, where they have their community decisions made. Communities will come together to make decisions. This is the entity in which decisions are made, not by some characters in the federal capital somewhere. And the free enterprise model of Singapore. The Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885, also known as the Congo Conference or the West African Conference, sought to avoid conflict by regularizing European protectorates and colonies in Africa to effectively eradicate the slave trade and to avoid conflict between European powers. They had good intentions in most cases, I think. The European powers gathered at the conference in Berlin was seeking to prevent rising American, Russian, and Japanese encroachments in Africa. Make no mistake, if the Belgians and the British and the French and the Portuguese and the Germans had not come in, the Americans, the Japanese, the Arabs, the Russians would have. Africa was a vacuum. People living in mud huts and thatched roofs, walking around barefoot, carrying spears, are going to be colonized by somebody who's got better weapons. It's just what's going to happen. And so they might whinge and whine about who came, but they can praise God if Protestant nations like Britain, Germany, and Netherlands colonized them rather than Catholic nations like France and Belgium and Portugal, who didn't do as good a job. Because the Protestant nations always produced three times higher literacy rate than the Catholic countries. And you could just continue. If there's free enterprise, if there's multi-party democracy, if there's any freedom of anything in Africa, it's because they had a Protestant colonial power that taught those principles. The more Catholic, the more coup d'etats, because they're more top-down. Protestants more think for yourself, read the Bible, constitution, so on. However, due to lack of information and a very incomplete understanding of the realities of Africa, often borders are drawn along lines of longitude or latitude or utilizing a river. But the fact is tribes and nations live on both sides of those boundary lines, those arbitrary border markings. Doubtless they didn't fully realize the disasters they were doing at the time. However, in my missionary work, it's become clear that the map needs to be redrawn. Half of the Shangaan people live in Mozambique and half speak Portuguese, and the other half live in South Africa and speak English. Half of the Evemba people living in Angola, where they've learned Portuguese and they drive on the right-hand side of the road, whereas the other half are in Southwest Africa, Namibia, where they drive on the left-hand side of the road and learn Afrikaans or English. Does this make sense to anybody? Indeed, the Evemba are on two different time zones, even though they're north and south of one another. The Chichewa people have been divided between Malawi, Zambia, and Mozambique, and you could continue throughout Africa. In fact, the greatest conflicts in Africa, starting with the Biafran War of 1967 to 1970, where the Christian Igbos tried to secede from the Hausa North, the Muslims. Most of the Congo Wars, most of the long conflicts in Sudan, have all could have been averted if the maps had reflected demographic realities and not forced some people to be minorities in their own country, oppressed by other tribes, cultures, or religions. Just think of the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, the wars there. If the map had been redrawn, you could have avoided this Islam-African conflict for a long time. Just take south of Nigeria, the Igbo people. The Igbo people are very productive, very advanced, but you know the problem? The oil is all in the south. In the north, do nothing, have nothing, and the oil isn't there. The oil isn't in the Muslim north, it's in the Christian south. So they wouldn't let the Christian south secede because they had the oil. And shamefully, Britain and America and China and Russia worked together to crush the Christians and support the Muslims in Nigeria. Only South Africa sent troops in support under Colonel Jan Breitenbach to the Biafrans during that horrible war. These are ethno-linguistic realities of Africa. And it makes no sense taking African people and forcing them to be a minority in an Islamic country and so on. And here are different linguistic family groups. And the thing is, we've got to understand countries from an ethno-linguistic point of view. This might be a more realistic way of drawing maps around literal nations. Well, do you know, before 1870, Germany was 300 countries. They had 300 kingdoms or princedoms or dukedoms, and there was a lot more freedom. Freedoms flourish in decentralized countries. Freedoms disappear the bigger the country gets. It's inexcusable that since independence, the Organization of African Unity has steadfastly refused to allow maps to be redrawn. Why? They want more power. These leaders of Africa are the biggest obstacle to maps being redrawn to reflect demographic, linguistic realities. They want the map to stay like this, because this is where their power base is, and they're on top. They do not want to give freedom to other people, like the Lithuanias, Latvias, and Estonias of Africa. The apparent exception being Eritrea, but Eritrea was a separate entity and recognized. They didn't actually redraw or change the boundary map from Berlin Conference, because Eritrea was a separate country. And the British forced Eritrea into Abyssinia and formed the new country of Ethiopia after the Second World War in 1945. And so that started the war from 1945 to 1991 till Eritrea reestablished their independence. Just showing again, stop meddling with countries' borders. Let them be natural. So redrawing the maps and recognizing the independence of South Sudan was a monumentally important precedent. The Nuba of South Kordofan at this moment fighting for their independence from Sudan. And the Kurds of Turkey, Iran, and Iraq are seeking their own country of Kurdistan. This is Kurdistan. You know who the Kurds are? The Medes. Daniel Lion's Den, Darius the Mede, the man who threw Daniel in the Lion's Den, he was a Mede, Kurd. Now, Kurdistan would be a bigger country than, in fact, Iraq. Winston Churchill, as first lord of the colonial secretary and so on of the First World War, he redrew the maps into the present Middle Eastern chaos. And he refused all the delegates from the Kurds to give them any independence, and made them part of Turkey, part of Iraq, and part of Iran. And so the Kurds are scattered. They used to be a great empire. They were once a world leader, Medo-Persian Empire. So where are the Kurds? 18 million are oppressed under the Turks. 2 million are in Syria. 5 million are in Iraq, and 8 million are in Iran. And 2 million scattered through the rest of the world. Kurdistan should be its own country. But when the Kurds resisted the British redrawing the map, Winston Churchill ordered them bombed with mustard gas by Sopwith camels in the 1920s. The evils done to the Kurds are shocking. And by the way, many Kurds have come to Christ in recent years. We've also got the Catalonians fighting for independence right now in Spain, and they've got a very good case. In fact, this is what Europe looks like. If you look at Europe from linguistic, ethnolinguistic, people group ways of considering it, the maps are not reflective of reality in many cases. Here is another map in terms of just your basic DNA. And so you can see the Germanic people are the blue, the Celtic people are the purple. You've got the Greco-Slavic, and then you've got the Near Eastern, and so on and so forth. So you've got the Arabic on this side, and the Baltic, Finnic, and so on. So this is just from an ethnic makeup on terms of DNA. There's different ways to understand the maps of Europe, but you can see that Estonia is an actual country. It's a nation. Latvia and Lithuania are actual countries, nations, whereas a lot of boundaries, geographic entities, encompass many nations. I mean, South Africa's got 11 official languages, so we're at least 11 nations. And these are just looking at those people who are Germanic in Europe, for example. This would be, for example, the Germanic people predominating area. These are different groups that are at this moment advocating for independence, which includes Frisia, Catalonia. Catalonia. And then, of course, you've got Aragon, you've got the Basques. The Basques have been after independence for quite a while. Sicily could be a case. So there's quite a lot of independence movements who may or who may not get the independence. You may wonder, why Bavaria? Because most of Germany is Protestant, but Bavaria is German Catholic. They might even want to join Austria for that matter. Potentially independent states in Europe, Nagorno-Karabakh, then island of Christianity and a sea of Islam, have been fighting very bravely since 1989 against Muslims around and doing very well for themselves, winning their battles. Sardinia could easily become an independent country, and so on. So, the map of Europe, in terms of real ethno-linguistic people groups, could one day look like this, if you have a real explosion of freedom instead of Tower of Babel business. So, the map could get more interesting. Have you considered Hong Kong? Why is Hong Kong not independent? Do you know, interestingly, the old British colonial flag for Hong Kong is being used by the resistance movements, the protest movements in Hong Kong. They are complaining Britain never gave them a referendum on whether they wanted to go independent or join Red China. They didn't want to join Red China, and so they're now opposing Chinese colonists get out. Hong Kong's got a great history of freedom and free enterprise and being a tax haven, and they don't like being part of Red China. And so there's a lot of protest right now, and interesting how they're using the old Union Jack, the old British flag, to speak for freedom. We recorded my case for Cape Independence some time ago. We've got the principle of scripture, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. You can see and read articles on this and other of our presentations on Reformation Societies on our reformationsa.org website, PowerPoints, audios, videos. Every week we're tackling these sort of things on from the Frontline Audio. And you'll see there's quite a lot on the video and audio gallery on the Frontline Web Masses. The book I've written on Faith Under Fire Sedan is on a successful independence secessionist movement. So, any questions, comments on secession? Yes.
What about Swaziland and Lesotho?
Those are good examples. Swaziland and Lesotho are countries that effectively seceded from South Africa. They were part of, well, geographically they look part of South Africa, but they were recognized to be an ethno-linguistic people group. So Swaziland is the Swazis. It's homogeneous. It's got one language, one culture, one ethno-linguistic group, and they've got a king. And same with Lesotho. I think the fact that they both had kings made it easier for Britain to give them separate independence. But you could look at Botswana, who also has independence. And so those are places that were once administratively part of British South Africa, but they were given separate independence. So there's no reason why Natal, the Free State, the Transvaal, Kingdom of Zululand, Transkei, shouldn't also be given their own independence. And you can have good relationships with your neighbors. You don't have to have barbed wire borders between you. You can have good relationships, as happens in Europe. Switzerland is free and independent. But they allow a lot of free travel across the border for people coming in for tourism and trade and so on. So, other comments, questions?
It's funny, when I was growing up, like studying and everything, because at some period, apparently, I was probably not born yet, but Katanga wanted to get independence from Congo.
Yes.
And then the president today did everything to bring like the country together, unity, and like, so like he's recognized as a hero, but his father is recognized as a hero today. And like when you grow up, they were saying how like we must like stay united, like different ethnicity, one people, and like love and everything. Like they were showing us how, because Burundi is one of the bordering countries of Congo, and like most of people, okay, there is the Tutsis and the Hutus, but they all speak Kirundi, they all speak one language. But for us, we speak many, like a lot of languages. And they're like, that's not like a country must have like different languages, and like showing us how we should just hate the division of our country, we want to stay together. Huh. So we grew up with that mindset.
Yeah.
That when I came here for the first time and like hearing like they want to divide South Africa, I was like, come on, like can people just stay together? And like, because of the, so I guess if they do that to the children until they grow up, then it's difficult for them to do a referendum to get independence.
And America's the worst. They brainwash their kids no end about how evil secession is and how one nation. I mean, even as to stand at the beginning of school and to pledge allegiance, to hand over your heart to the flag of the United States of America, indivisible, one nation. It's not even logical. It's not one nation. But why should it be indivisible? So if you think of the Congo, why was it wrong of Katanga to go free? Katanga was the most peaceful, productive, Christian part of the Congo. And at the time that Moise Tshombe declared independence, secession from Congo, he said, we are seceding from chaos. And that was what it was. The Congo was in chaos. This Patrice Lumumba, who was a communist, so evil that, in fact, they were sacrificing missionaries in front of his image in what was then called Stanleyville, what now is Lubumbashi. And so they were literally doing human sacrifice. You read about this New Tribes Mission, Unevangelized Field Mission. They lost vast amounts. Hundreds of missionaries were murdered by the Simbas, the communists. Many of them sacrificed in cold blood before the image. They had a big picture of Moise Tshombe, and they were sacrificing in front of him. The communists in the Soviet Union ran a training camp. It was called the Moise Tshombe University. Moise Tshombe is a good man. Patrice Lumumba is the evil Marxist. The communists named their university for communist terrorists from around the world the Patrice Lumumba University. So, you know, he's like the Che Guevara of Africa, in a sense. And Moise Tshombe was a good man, a Christian, who wanted to secede from chaos, and Katanga was well run. How did Katanga get forced back into the Congo? The United Nations invaded. They bombed Elizabethville, which today is called Lubumbashi. They came in, they bombed them, they bombed hospitals, schools, churches, they looted homes, they murdered people in cold blood at UN roadblocks. Pakistanis, Moroccans, hideous things what the UN did in Katanga. And I know because some of the people in the school benches next to me in Bulawayo came from Katanga. They had fled across northern Rhodesia to southern Rhodesia. And so at that moment, the favorite movie out there was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., two United Nations spies, a Russian agent and American agent working for peace and freedom. They were The Man from U.N.C.L.E. from the United Nations. And they were, you know, U.N.C.L.E. sounds such a nice, friendly term. And so I thought the UN were the heroes, and I actually had the Man from U.N.C.L.E. type of toys and all that sort of thing. Then the children next to me are saying, no, but the UN are the ones who bombed our town, stole our things, looted our possessions before we could cross the border into northern Rhodesia, what today is Zambia. And so even at a young age, I was learning what I see on the screen isn't necessarily the truth, which is quite useful to know. But I thought the Katangans were right in seeking independence. I mean, that was the opinion I grew up with. But then again, I was in a country that had seceded from Great Britain, so we were more pro-secession just from a mindset, whereas the Americans are just, you can't even think about secession. I mean, that's a thought crime. So in many countries around the world, they're drumming it into people, unity, unity, unity. But what do we get in the Bible? When the music plays, you all bow down before this statue I've set up in the plains of Dura. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, no, and they stand firm. Our God and we serve is able to save us, and he will. But even if he doesn't, we still won't bow before your idols, nor will you serve your gods. So the Christian attitude is one of resistance, or at least for Protestants. I mean, we're meant to be Protestants. We're meant to protest, resist. We shouldn't conform. So if the world's saying something, we should question it at the least. Other questions, comments, observations?
Do you think the former countries from behind the Iron Curtain, do you think they're taking a step backward now that they're part of the EU?
Yes. In fact, that's not just my opinion, it's their opinion. So, friends of mine in Romania, did a lot of work in Romania, got a lot of friends in Romania. My wife was baptized in Romania. She's got hordes of friends in Romania. And Bill Bathlin was beloved there. I've traveled all over Romania with him, and wow, what a country. As the Berlin Wall came down, now I went to Romania before and after the Christmas Revolution when they killed Ceausescu and so on Christmas Day. And the church bells are ringing and saying, we've killed Dracula on Christmas Day. And you know, that's just the term of endearment they used for Ceausescu. So at the beginning, the first thing that happened is they asked the pastor of the local church to stand up in the town hall and to preach the gospel to everyone. And in the city square, and they were singing and preaching and open, and everything being done, the pastors were coming and leading and so on, in the schools, and Christianity just had full reign. And once that you're in the EU, suddenly, oh, you're not allowed to pray in the schools, and you're not allowed, oh, now you've got to have evolution in schools. Oh, you've got to legalize abortion. You can't be part of the EU if you don't legalize abortion. And so the people in Romania said, it's like we've moved from the Warsaw Pact into the Western Warsaw Pact. And it said, we had this brief window of freedom, and then we joined the EU, and we've lost a whole lot of our freedoms. And now you see this resistance. Poland saying, we will not legalize abortion. And Slovakia saying, we won't take one Muslim. And Hungary. And so you've got resistance. And it looks like the Eastern Europe ones are the only ones with backbone in Europe, because they knew how to resist communism. But the Western Europeans are a bunch of wimps. They're just like rolling over and being doormats. No, shame on them. But no, I think it's extraordinary that Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland are some of the most shining lights in Europe right now in terms of resisting, and Russia, actually. They're resisting the EU Tower of Babel nonsense. So good for them. Other comments, questions, observations?
So South Sudan having seceded recently, well, a couple of years ago from Sudan, and then people look at that now and say, well, it doesn't look like a very hopeful or successful secession. What would you say to them?
Yes. Of course, it's better than what they had under the Arabs, where they had no freedom, Islamization, Arabization. They've got religious freedom. The church able to do a lot. We're able to take in the past, they had to smuggle in the Bibles illegally. Now, John and Ben and Aubrey and Hunter have managed to take in Bibles openly. And it's not illegal. There's bribery, there's corruption, there's incompetence. But it's light years better from what it was when it was at war with the Islamic North. So at least they're open to the gospel and so on. But they didn't draw the map again. The trouble is, yes, they separate from Islamic North, but they should have given Upper Nile separate independence from Equatoria and from Bahr el-Ghazal. They should be three countries. And the reason why I say it is, okay, you've got these two people, Silva Kiir, the man I've met and spoken to, who's now the president, who to some degree, I would say he's more on the right on this. And then you've got the former president, Riek Machar. Now, Riek Machar comes from Upper Nile. Riek Machar is a crook, complete and utter crook. Here's Riek Machar. Here's Silver Keir. Now, they were enemies. During the war, Silver Keir fought the Arabs. Riek Machar fought for the Arabs against the Christians. Riek Machar's crowd killed more Dinkas than the Arabs did. Now, with the destruction, here's Silver Keir. Sorry, this is Riek Machar. Riek Machar, he's the head of the SSIM of Upper Nile. He was a surrogate for the Arabs. And during the war, he was killing Dinka because he's a Nuer. Now, this man, this Jimmy Carter, ex-president of America, I used to think he's the worst president America had ever had, but I was told that, Franklin Delano Roosevelt gets that prize. He betrayed how many countries behind Iron Curtain to the Soviet Union and so on. But anyway, Jimmy Carter betrayed 11 countries to communism in his miserable 4 years in office, including Rhodesia, Nicaragua, and a whole lot of others. And, of course, Iran to the hands of the Ayatollah. He's the one who forced out America's ally, the Shah of Iran. So Jimmy Carter's got a lot to answer for. But since he's been kicked out and Ronald Reagan took his place, very nice day that was, he's been running around as America's elder statesman, wrecking new countries. So he persuaded Silver Keir to take Riek Machar, his enemy, and make him his vice president. You know, kumbaya, this kind of let's all join hands and sway together. And this is insane. Riek Machar was a surrogate for Arabs, and for over 13 years he was killing Dinka, and he destroyed more than 1 million of their cattle in scorched earth. Now, these guys, we know who they are. I mean, this is Omar al-Bashir. He was for 30 years the dictator of Sudan. He's the one who caused so much of the grief. And Omar al-Tarabi, his prophet, like beast, false prophet, that's the name. This is where they lock up Christians. Okay. Who's this? Omar al-Bashir. Who's that? Riek Machar. This is after the independence of South Sudan. Riek Machar's the vice president. He's in charge of oil. Does it look from the body language here that these people are enemies? At the end of the first year of independence, so we're talking about 9th of July 2012, Silver Keir at the independence celebrations in Juba announces bravely, we are missing $5 billion. I didn't know they had $5 billion to lose, but we've lost $5 billion in our first year of independence. Now, where did that $5 billion go? He says it's got to be returned. But next year, only $200 million have been recovered, so he fires his vice president and the entire cabinet, which personally I think is totally justified, and I think it's admirable that he at least acknowledged the corruption and did something about it. Well, Riek Machar is the number one suspect because he's the one dealing with all the oil deals with the government. You see, yes, South Kordofan, the oil pipeline goes up there to the Red Sea. Here's the oil pipeline going all the way up to the Red Sea through Sudan. Obviously, if they could have a pipeline through Kenya, that would really help so they don't have to go through Arab North. But the civil war that Riek Machar engineered, because the moment he got fired, his presidential guard started firing on the other presidential guard, so then you had tribal war because he's nowhere and all of his soldiers are nowhere, and Riek Machar is the vice president, he's nowhere, where Silver Keir, he's Dinka, and so you had the Dinka and the nowhere killing one another in great numbers. This American woman, I forget her name for a moment, but she was the Obama's advisor sent to advise him, and her advice was always ghastly. It was always, take Riek Machar back and make him vice president again. I don't know how many times this was done. And every time the war would break out again and the corruption. South Sudan was doomed from the first day because they accepted terrible advice from Jimmy Carter. Number one, be a secular state. No prayer, no minute of silence, secular state. They want to be a Christian country. No, you can't have Christian emblem on your flag. You can't have Christian this thing. You've got to be a secular state. UNICEF will provide you textbooks. You know, secular humanism, gender, evolution, all that stuff. And you've got to have this traitor, Riek Machar, who's been serving the Arabs and killing your people more than Arabs did. and make him your vice president. This is death knell. This is, how could it work? So from the very first day that they accepted independence on that foundation, it was ruined and wrecked. If they'd just given Riek Machar his own country of Upper Nile to rule the Nuba people, the Nuer people, and if Silver Key had had the Dinka, and if they'd had a totally decentralized Swiss-type model, free enterprise and so on, it would have worked. But the centralized system, 27 ethno-linguistic language groups in South Sudan, 27. But the two big ones are the Nuer and the Dinka. To have at least drawn a map and given the Nuer their own territory, but it's a recipe for civil war. And so I'm sorry to say that they did not listen to our advice. They did not decentralize. They did not free market. They went a centralized state way, and they accepted the state textbooks. The 100 Christian schools that I established and provided Christian textbooks with, thousands of Christian textbooks over the years, they all are using UNICEF textbooks today, I believe. UNICEF's just moved in, and they've given free textbooks, and they've destroyed good Christian schools with their corruption. And so the country's back to civil war. So, yes, independence and secession on its own is not good enough. It's got to be on a biblical basis. It's got to be decentralized. It's got to be free enterprise. And you've got to keep redrawing the map so that it's so decentralized. I think you've got to bring all the power down to the local municipality, genuine local communities, where the local community controls their own police, they control their own taxes, they control how it's spent, and there's accountability. But the more centralized and the bigger the country, the more the corruption, the more the looting, and the less it works. So just think Soviet Union versus Latvia. You know, I mean, it's a no-brainer. So that's my answer. It's that South Sudan needed independence. It is better than it used to be under the Arabs and the war, but it's light years from where it should be. Because they've allowed this godfather of secular humanism, old Jimmy Carter, to take them way off the path. And it's, the country's like this. It's a bit of a wreck. And I must say, I was quite hurt to get the report backs from John and Aubrey on what a corrupt country South Sudan is and what a corrupt place Juba is, because it didn't have to go that way. That's sad.
What's like their hope? What's going on now? Is it like still war? Like,
John?
What hope do you see for them?
You've been there more recently than me. What do you say?
Yeah, there's still always back and forth between Silver Kiir, Riek Machar. Nobody believes them, though. I mean, when we were there last time, they were speaking about, Riek Machar was saying he forgives, and Silver Kiir was saying, I forgive, and all this stuff. And I was asking the people, what do you think of this? They're saying nonsense. They've said this hundreds of times. I mean, the Dinka are never going to share power, and well, neither will the Nuer. So
it's a recipe for more war.
It's not very hopeful. And on top of that, the whole country's suckling off the UN the whole time. And the UN and all the NGOs are thriving off of what's going on there, because it gives them justification for their existence. So, I mean, not to be a prophet of doom, but there isn't immediate great hope unless there's a massive revival of the Holy Spirit and people get saved and love their enemies.
Yes.
I mean, that's the best hope.
Yes. John's reminded me of something super important there. You can't get independence if you're going to move on to dependence of the UN. The UN is also a neo-colonialistic, neo-imperialistic power. You've got to, if you want freedom, you've got to break away from all of it. And when you think of secession, okay, I look forward to an independent Cape of Good Hope. But realistically, most of that's out of my power. But what I can do is I can personally secede from SABC. In fact, I've cut them out of my life for the last 30 years. I can personally secede from the government's indoctrination gulag, and we've been homeschooling. I can personally secede from the cursed newspapers and, you know, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, the Clinton News Network, the Slime Magazine, the Cape Crimes, the Sunday Crimes. I don't care what any of them say. I'm seceding from the whole lot. I'm not going to let them indoctrinate me, brainwash me, deceive me, distract me. I'm going to stick to the Bible and to Christian sources. I want to be open to what other Bible-believing Christians are saying, but I'm not open to what the secular humanists are saying. I'm not going to accept their lies and guilt manipulation anymore. So you can secede as an individual and as a family. And that's where independence starts. I don't need the government. I won't live on their welfare. I'm not going to operate by their rules. And so if we as individuals develop that attitude, that's what the Four Trekkers did. They said, we've had it with this Cape government who want to tax us but not protect us and so on and so forth. We're getting in our ossevars and we're going off and we're going to find our own promised land where we'll rule ourselves. We'll be our own education department, our own defense department, our own everything. Nobody gave them a thing. But they showed we can do it better. And I've got one excellent example of how the Cape doesn't need the government. Well, I could give two. Back in 1994, in the year 2000, we had oil disasters around our coast which threatened the lives of our penguins. On both occasions, citizens, volunteers, saved the penguins, cleaned the beaches, saved the day. Government did nothing but cause the problem. And so on both occasions, we showed that, in fact, I think there were 68,000 Cape Town volunteers, and some volunteers came from overseas too, but volunteers saved 55,000 African penguins from destruction in the year 2000. And government did nothing except cause the problems. And so if you look at why is it that Adderley Street doesn't look as good as Century City or the waterfront? Well, difference between municipal run and private ownership. Private ownership's better. Government is just breeding ground for corruption. So the less government we have and the more personal responsibility, the better. So I would say, well, I like the idea of decentralization, independence worldwide, and I'll teach on it. But until it happens, I and my family and our mission, we're seceding anyway from the whole. We're not part of your whole charade. We're not interested. And we're not going to repeat your mantras. We're not going to participate in your Mandela days and things like that.
Something that seems to work a bit better, especially in Zambia, is where they have still a chief of the area. Now the chief is controlling the area. It looks like it's working better, at least than the Zimbabwean government and things.
Yes, indeed. Well, again, I just think of how unbelievably efficient Rhodesia was. And nobody starved. We had droughts. We had all kinds of disasters, but nobody starved in Rhodesia. It didn't matter how bad the situation was because people were responsible. And people were just all, they did it for themselves so much. And that's what you need. Whereas in the communist countries, you see this helpless mentality of the government must do something. I cannot do anything to help myself. When we first started going to Zambia, it was still under Kohinda. And there were the people right next to the Zambezi River, for goodness sake. It's 200 meters away. And they're dying of starvation because of the drought. Said, you're next to the greatest river in southern Africa, the Zambezi. Why didn't you irrigate? Government must do that. We can't irrigate. How about you just carry some buckets of water at sunset? So you've got all night for it to seep in without any evaporation. The government must do that. And so, okay, your children are going to starve. You're starving because you're waiting for the government. You know the government's not going to do it. But there was this helpless attitude. I'm a helpless victim of circumstances. That is an animistic mentality. A Christian mentality is, I can do all things through God who strengthens me. Greater is he is in me than him is in the world. Christians need to have the submit to God, resist the devil. He will flee from us mentality. We can't just be victims of the New World Order. We have to make our own future. And of course, communities, congregations, families, extended families, networks, that's all important. But those are real relationships. But this coercion where the government comes and says, give us all your money and we will do everything for you. And then they've got some reason why they couldn't fulfill their promises. No.
And when they lie to you, where they've thrown it away, they've hidden it away.
You know, whenever they come up with, we need to increase this tax for this. You don't need to increase taxes. Why don't you just abolish the tax and go after all the corruption? If you could recover the corruption, you'd have enough money for the next 50 years. They have stolen this country blind. The African Union says 32% of the gross domestic product of South Africa is stolen by the government every year. 32%. That's not counting corruption. That's not counting inflation. That's just counting corruption. Not even inflation and taxation, which I'm convinced more than half of everything we have is stolen every year by the government. Corruption. It's just staggering. Just think how efficient we could be if we went down to 1% tax. which is the model for TEAL, Total Economic Activity Levy. Hong Kong and Singapore, they don't even have 1% tax. It's less than that. But just think what you could do for the kingdom of God and for your family and for education and for wildlife and so many good causes if we weren't being stolen every day from by this corrupt government. So I've looked at just a few of the things. I want to look at why secessions fail in a future presentation, because there are failed secession movements, Sudan being unfortunately one of them that they took a wrong turn from independence. They kept the centralized model. That's the first thing I saw that's wrong. They listened to the UN and Jimmy Carter. They didn't redraw the map. They didn't decentralize. They didn't operate in a truly free enterprise way. And what's the government doing running oil anyway? And why is the UN there once they got their independence? I mean, they should have been like Rwanda. Rwanda says, we don't want aid. We want fair trade. And Rwanda chased out the UN, won't even allow the UN in. And Rwanda is actually one of the more effective countries in Africa, economically and so on. It's doing spectacularly well. When we did our 12-country Livingstone 200 overland, the team said that the best country they traveled across in all of Africa, in those 12 countries, including South Africa, was Rwanda. Which I was quite shocked about, because Rwanda wasn't that good when I was there last, but a lot has happened. Free enterprise helped. And kicking the UN definitely helps. I think Sudan, when I first started going to Sudan, the Sudanese people I met were, they were all self-sufficient. They did everything for themselves. They got no help from anyone, anywhere. And they were all very, very, you could just see the industry and the hard work and everyone, the bishops out there building and fixing and clearing the fields and carrying logs and helping to build the church. Just everyone was involved. The district commissioner was involved. Nobody was above hard work. It doesn't sound like that right now.
The United Nations are setting up this what death traps for. I mean, like concentration camp, and like the Nuero people or the Dinka people want to attack them. They're not going to offend the people. That's the problem.
Well, the UN will stand by and do absolutely nothing when you're in trouble. John, you were going to say?
Well, the people are just totally dependent on foreign aid. So they won't do anything without extra money. And money is nothing over there. The US dollar is nothing.
Because they've got so much of it.
There's so much money going around over there and just being wasted. And not only that, but because of war, the people are not living in their homes. They're not living in their, most of them are not living in their tribal regions anymore. They're not living in a place where they can really care.
So there's no community.
No community. No, not at all. So that, I mean, sure, that adds to it significantly. Why is the average person going to care about their street, their neighborhood, or whatever when they're just there temporarily because, you know, their home is just
migrant refugees, basically.
Well,
that's what I loved about Sudan when I first got there. You didn't need to lock a thing. There was no crime. I mean, they wouldn't tolerate. Everything was just, it was a community. There were such strong communities. But then I was with the Moro. I was with the Bari. I was with the Zandi. They were an effective community. But yes, multiculturalism and urbanization is a catastrophe. Destroys families, congregations, everything. Morals and faith. So yeah, this is the challenge. At any rate, this, by the way, is one of the first chaplains we trained, Chaplain Peter Jonathan. And we trained him first in 1996, one of the first of the four chaplains. And you met him on recent mission up there. So he's still going strong, which is good to hear. He's got onto the academic kick too. He's been doing lots and lots and lots of study. But, yep, well, those are just some of the backgrounds on independence models. Well, I think Eastern Europe, Daniel, do you want to say something about what you saw in Latvia at the Riga? What do you thought of a place like Bratislava?
Yeah, we were actually there the year they were cultural capital of the world in that year, 2014. Yeah, it was beautiful. Beautiful gardens, very well manicured, lovely people, and even their outfits, their traditional ones, very nice.
And yet if you read Bill Bathurst's and Brother Andrew's books of what it was like in the 70s and 80s, you could hardly believe the same country. independence has made them completely different. It's just extraordinary.
Oh.
Well, and yet those places would have been hellholes under the Soviet Union. They achieved the independence and they've made the countries work. I have a hope and a vision that we can have a great community in the Cape if we take back our communities. And it starts in a municipality. It starts community-wise, but we've got to build it up. I saw Billy had a practice of working on cleaning up his neighborhood. I mean, that's where it starts. You start with your neighborhood. If we can get our neighborhoods right, tree planting, canal and river cleaning, animal rescuing, communities, congregations, outreaches. And most important, I think, of all of it, though, is you've got to disengage from the brainwashing, indoctrination, gulags of the state schools and of the state media, because otherwise you can't even think straight. We've got to plug into God's word and unplug from the world before we can even think about making a free and independent country. Because that's the problem with our dear friends in Sudan. They're unplugged from the Islamic regime in Khartoum and plugged right into the United Nations. And it's like they've gone from, what's it, between Scylla and Charybdis, or the devil and deep blue sea. They've moved from one evil to the other. And I mean, the United Nations is not a solution to anything. Our friends in Rwanda discovered that.